Chapter 21, Blood and Booty.
We ask thee for the booty of this town and its people.
Year 7 of the Islamic era got off to a horrendous start. The Prophet, without provocation, led a terrorist raid to torment another Jewish community.
Tabari and Ishaq. After his return from Hudaybiyah, Allah's messenger marched against Khaybar. He halted with his army in a valley between the people of Khaybar and the Gaftan tribe to prevent the latter from assisting the Jews.
The motivation for the attack was obvious. Muhammad's militant and mercenary horde was up in arms over his capitulation at Hudaybiyah. Out of control, they would have turned against their warlord if he hadn't found a way to satiate their growing lust for blood, for babes, and for booty. For those who think that this conclusion is unfair and overly cynical, consider the facts. When the Muslims failed to capture the Meccan caravan at Badr, the Prophet stole the property and the possessions of the Kanuka Jews. Following the Uhud defeat, he immediately plundered the Nadir Jews. The siege of the trench was not only the third in a series of 4 battles without booty, it was also bloodless. So Islam's demented dictator provided slaughter, sex, and spoil by murdering, enslaving, and robbing the Quraiza. The Jews had become easy prey. So following the bootyless and bloodless peace of Hudaybiyah, Muhammad set out to terrorize the only Jewish community within reach that he hadn't previously sacked and plundered, Khaybar. It was their turn to feel the wrath of Islam. Incidentally, neither Allah, Muhammad, Ishaq, Tabari, Bukhari, nor Muslim made any attempt to justify Islam's ruthless assault on the Khaybar Jews. They knew the truth and didn't try to disguise it. Islam was no longer a religion. It was a terrorist dogma. The first Muslims weren't disciples. They were mercenaries. Muhammad wasn't a prophet. He was a pirate. Allah wasn't a god. He was the devil incarnate. And together, they were about to prove that they were a blight on humankind. As transparent as ever, these words directly from Muhammad's lips demonstrate that he was working for the prince and power of the air, the lord of devils, the prince of darkness, the great deceiver, the adversary, Satan.
Ishaq. When the apostle looked down on Khaybar, he told his companions, O Allah, Lord of the heavens, and what they overshadow, and Lord of the devils, and what error they throw, and Lord of the winds, and what they winnow, we ask thee for the booty of this town and its people. We take refuge in thee from its evil, and from the evil of its people. Forward in the name of Allah. He used to say this of every town he raided.
Serving Satan was no easy task. Good and evil had to be redefined so that the good people of Khaybar, who were just going about their lives trying to make an honest living, had to be called evil. And the bad terrorist thugs, lurking in the hills above them, armed to the teeth and ready to pounce on the unsuspecting village, murdering, enslaving, robbing, and raping them, had to be called good.
Ishaq. When the apostle raided a people, he waited until morning, and then he attacked. We came to Khaybar at night. When morning came and he did not hear the call to prayer, he rode and we rode with him. We met the workers of Khaybar coming out in the morning with their spades and baskets. When they saw the Prophet and our army, they cried, Muhammad with his force! They turned tail and fled. The apostle yelled, Allahu Akbar! Khaybar is destroyed! When we arrive at a people's square, it is a bad morning for them.
All of the deceptions, justifications, and apologies ever spoken would be insufficient to make this horrible day appear religious. And it does not stand alone. Khaybar was one of 75 merciless raids instigated by the first Muslims. Armed raiders attack civilians for no other reason than to seize their possessions. Allahu Akbar was the terrorist prayer of fear. Ishaq's compilation of Islamic scripture, the inspired sirah or biography of the Prophet, is the earliest and most accurate accounting of Muhammad's life and of the formation of Islam. It was compiled a century before Tabari, before Muslim and Bukhari. But for those who might want to dismiss the Hadith report on the basis that it sounds too condemning of the Prophet, consider these confirming words from Ibn Bukhari. Of his collection, Islamic sages wrote,
"Second only to the Quran, Bukhari's Hadith is the most important book in Islam."
So Bukhari claims,
"Allah's apostle reached Kabar at night. It was his habit that when he reached an enemy at night, he would not attack them until it was morning. When morning came, the Jews came out with their spades and baskets. When they saw the Prophet, they said, 'Muhammad, oh dear God, it's Muhammad and his army.' The Prophet shouted, 'Allahu Akbar, Kabar is destroyed, for whenever we approach a nation, evil will be the mourning for those who have been warned.'"
The more you know, the worse it gets. This is why Islamic leaders must keep good people from reading these words. It is why they lie to themselves, to our citizens, to the media, and to politicians alike. Islam is self-destructive, mutilating its own credibility. The Hadith said Muhammad made a habit of this perverse behavior. The Jews were his enemy, although none had ever lifted a finger in violence towards him. The Jews were farmers, going to work with gardening tools, and yet Muhammad led a surprise attack against them with his army. He professed destruction, not salvation. But it's the last line that's especially haunting. With Islam, the nations of the world are approached by evil. Muhammad's ruthless terrorist campaign against the townships of Kareza and Kabar was worse than Osama bin Laden's assault on New York and Washington. The first Islamic terrorist was more destructive, savage, and sadistic than his later-day incarnations in the Taliban, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Muslim Brotherhood, Black September, Jamaah Islamiyah, Aska Martyrs Brigade, Al-Qaeda, and Islamic Jihad. And Muslims know it. In their media, in their mosque, and in their madrasa, they compel young boys and girls to follow Muhammad's example. When they bomb our buildings, blow holes in our ships, hijack our planes, kidnap our people, they are doing what their prophet did. Islam cannot be fixed. It cannot be reformed. Islam cannot coexist with civilized people. It is a terrible disease. Through indoctrination, Islam destroys Muslim minds. It corrodes them. By way of its grotesque immorality and criminal nature, it attacks Muslim hearts, corrupting them. Worst of all, by way of deceit and deception, Islam beguiles Muslim souls, damning them. To add insult to injury, Bukhari noted,
"The Prophet offered the Fajr prayer, or the prayer of fear, near Kabar when it was still dark. He said, 'Allahu Akbar, Allah is greatest. Kabar is destroyed, for whenever we approach a hostile nation to fight, then evil will be the mourning for those who have been warned.' Then the inhabitants of Kabar came out running on the roads. The Prophet had their men killed, their children and women were taken captives."
Calling the Jews a hostile nation is a complete farce. Muhammad and his Muslim militants, according to their own accounting, had either murdered, terrorized, enslaved, or raped tens of thousands of Jews. Yet the Jews had killed but one Muslim, and even that was in self-defense, allegedly occurring during the Islamic siege of the Kareza. The warning these Jews were given before evil befell them was no different than Muslims provide today. The 9/11 terrorists shouted, "Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater," before they slaughtered thousands. By proclaiming the prayer of fear, Islamic terrorists tell us who they are, what they believe, and why they kill. There is nothing Islam could do to make their terrorist nature more obvious.
Bukhari, when Allah's apostle fought the Battle of Kabar, or when he raided any other people, they raised their voices, crying, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar! None has the right to be worshipped except Allah."
Muslims will continue to terrorize until every soul submits to Islam.
On that, Allah's apostle said, "Lower your voices, for you are not calling a deaf or absent one, but a hearer who is with you." On that he said to me, "O Abdallah, shall I tell you a sentence, which is one of the treasures of paradise?" I said, "Yes, O Allah's apostle, let my father and mother be sacrificed for your sake."
What an utterly perverse and odd thing to say.
He said, "It is, that neither might nor power, but with Allah."
Then why, pray tell, did he require militants to kill and pillage for him?
Tabari and Ishaq. So Muhammad began seizing their herds and their property bit by bit. He conquered Kabar home by home. The first stronghold defeated was Naim. Next was Kumus, the community of Abi Hukaik. The messenger took some of its people captive, including Safia bint Huyay, the wife of Kinana, and her two cousins. The prophet chose Safia for himself.
Perverted is too kind a word for this man. He became the first serial rapist to call himself a prophet. And make no mistake, having sex with a captive is rape.
Tabari. Diya asked the messenger for Safia when the prophet chose her for himself. Muhammad gave Diya her two cousins instead.
It was a two-for-one deal. The prophet could be so considerate.
Ishaq. When Diya protested, wanting to keep Safia for himself, the apostle traded for Safia, giving Diya her two cousins. The women of Kabar were distributed among the Muslims.
Muhammad had men killed so that he could have sex with their wives and with their daughters. He traded human beings. And the prophet rewarded his Muslim militants by distributing the remaining women among them. Then, faced with this problem, Muhammad used some magic to turn rape into an approved Islamic act. The sleight of hand was called the mut'ah. It's a 3-day marriage, giving he and his militants a license to do with their prisoners whatever they pleased. But on this day, only the prophet's indiscretion was approved.
Bukhari. On the day of Kabar, Allah's apostle forbade the muta, or temporary marriage. Bukhari. The prophet had their men killed, their children and women taken as captives. Safia was amongst the captives. She first came in the share of Diya, but later on she came to belong to the prophet. Muhammad made her manumission.
Webster defines manumission as a medieval word signifying the authority of a master to release one from slavery.
As her mahar,
or wedding gift. Translated into common English, Muhammad performed some Islamic hocus-pocus to make non-consensual sex seem moral. And that's all Islam ever was. It was just an act, an Oscar-winning performance by one of the great con artists of all time. The Bukhari tradition winds down with these words.
The captives of Kabar were divided among the Muslims. Then the messenger began taking their homes and property that were closest to him.
The prophet was busy establishing Islamic sunnah, or custom, on this day.
Ishaq. The apostle prohibited four things the morning of the Kabar raid: carnal intercourse with pregnant women who were captured, mingling his seed with another man's,
which means the Muslims were free to rape those who weren't pregnant.
Nor is it lawful for him to take,
rape,
her until she is in a state of cleanliness.
Not menstruating, something that bothered Muhammad enormously.
Nor can a Muslim eat the flesh of donkeys, nor eat any carnivorous animal, nor sell any booty before it has been duly allotted.
That's because the prophet took his cut off of the top, and he didn't want his cut diminished. The tradition continues to lay down the law.
Nor is it lawful for a Muslim to ride an animal belonging to the booty with the intention of returning it to the pool when he has worn it out. Nor is it lawful for him to wear a garment belonging to the booty of the Muslims with the intention of returning it to the pool
of stolen goods
when he has reduced it to rags.
If you desire to be a pirate, I suppose these might be words to live by.
Ishaq. On the day of Kabar, the apostle forbade us to buy or sell gold ore for gold coin, or silver ore for silver coin.
And that's because he who controls the bank, the means of commerce and trade, controls men by way of their wallets. Before we leave this rather dismal attempt to establish Islamic law, I want to solve the perplexing donkey conundrum. It's no small matter to Muslims. There were no fewer than a dozen Bukhari hadith from this day alone focused on the lowly ass. Let's see if we can figure out why.
Bukhari, on the day of Kibar, Allah's apostle forbade the eating of garlic and the meat of donkeys.
That wasn't much help. All it did was demonstrate that Muhammad was a fool. Garlic is nature's best antibiotic and thus should be consumed. But Muhammad wasn't much of a medicine man. This trio of prescriptions tell the tale.
Bukhari, the climate of Medina did not suit some of the people, so the Prophet ordered them to drink camel urine as a medicine.
And when that made them even sicker, he said,
Bukhari, I heard Allah's apostles saying, there is healing in black cumin for all diseases except death.
And lest we forget,
Bukhari, Allah's apostle said, if a fly falls in your drink, dip all of it in the cup and then throw it away, for in one of its wings there is a disease, and in the other there is healing, an antidote or treatment for that disease.
But foolish did not make him frivolous. The next tradition provides a clue as to why he was so upset.
Bukhari, someone came to Allah's apostle and said, donkeys have been eaten by Muslims. The Prophet kept quiet. The man again said, their donkeys have been eaten. The Prophet kept quiet. After the third time, the Prophet ordered his caller to announce, Allah and his apostle forbid you to eat the meat of donkeys. Then the cooking pots were overturned while the meat was still boiling in them.
I discovered this clue when I read Bukhari, Volume 5, Book 59, Number 531.
We were afflicted with severe hunger the day we raided Kibar. When the cooking pots were boiling and the food was ready to eat, the announcer of the Prophet said, do not eat anything, especially the donkey meat. Turn your cooking pots upside down and throw it away. We realized that the Prophet had prohibited such food because the kumis had not been taken out of it.
The kumis is the Prophet's share of all booty seized by Muslim militants. The donkeys belonged to the Jews. They were beasts of burden used to till the fields and carry crops to market. Thus they were a spoil to be divided, with Muhammad getting the largest share. And he would rather see his people starve than renounce his claim to stolen property. The first Islamic historian and biographer each report a hadith along the same lines.
Tabari and Ishaq, the Banu Sam of Aslam,
newly recruited Muslim militants,
came to the messenger and complained, Muhammad, we have been hurt by drought and possess nothing. Although they had fought for the Prophet, they found he had nothing.
He was willing
to give them. The apostle said, O Allah, you know their condition. I have no strength and nothing
I want
to give them
from the booty I have stolen.
So conquer for them the wealthiest of the Kibar homes, the one with the most food and fat meat.
In other words, steal your own booty. You'll starve before I share any of my confiscated wealth with you. Then, proving that Allah was a wannabe terrorist too.
Tabari, the next morning Allah opened the township of Sab bin Muda for them to conquer. There was no stronghold in Kibar more abounding in food. After the Prophet had defeated some of their settlements and taken their property, they reached the communities of Watib and Sualim, which were the last of the Kibar neighborhoods to be conquered. Muhammad besieged the inhabitants between 13 and 19 nights.
Calling Islam peaceful ranks as one of the most egregious lies of all time. It wasn't even war. The Muslims weren't out defending themselves or their religion. This was a terrorist raid and a racist bent. While Islam has always been violent, Muslims have seldom been good at it.
Ishaq and Tabari, encamped at their fortress, Muhammad presented his war banner to Abu Bakr and sent him against the Jews. He fought, but he retreated, suffering losses. The following morning, the same thing happened to Umar. When they returned to Muhammad, Umar's companions accused him of cowardice, and he accused them of the same. The messenger said, "Tomorrow I shall give the banner to a man who loves Allah and his messenger. Allah will conquer it by his means." The next day, Bakr and Umar vied for the war banner, but the Prophet called Ali, who was suffering from inflamed eyes, and having spat on his eyes, gave him the banner. Ali advanced upon the people of Kabar. In the fight, he lost his shield, so he laid hold of the fort door and used it as a shield. He kept it in his hand as he fought until Allah gave Muslims the victory. When the siege was over, 8 of us tried to lift the door, but we couldn't even turn it over.
Either the skinny-legged fat boy of Mecca got a personal trainer, or he found one hell of a propagandist. Abu Qadi Hadith starts off the same way, but ends rather oddly.
On the day of Kabar, Allah's apostle said, "Tomorrow I will give this flag to a man through whose hands Allah will give us victory." Ali said, "O Allah's apostle, I will fight them till they become like us."
Like us? Does that mean cruel? Demonic? Does that mean they'll become mercenaries and terrorists?
Allah's apostle said, "Proceed, and when you enter their town, call them to embrace Islam and inform them of Allah's rights, which they should observe. For if a single man is led on the right path of Islam by Allah through you, then that will be better for you than nice red camels."
I don't know what is more perverse, suggesting that the victims of a terrorist raid should be called to Islam before they are slaughtered, robbed, enslaved, and raped, or suggesting that a man's soul is better than
nice red camels.
Moving on, the Sunnis wanted us to know that Abu Bakr and Umar were no less brutal than Ali.
Tabari, the messenger often had migraines and would remain a day or two without coming out. When Muhammad encamped at Kabar, he came down with a migraine and did not come out. Bakr took the Prophet's war banner and fought vigorously. Next, Umar took it and fought with even more ferocity than the first fighting.
Then, in some of the most despicable words ever scribed in the name of religion, we read in both Tabari and Ishaq,
"Ali struck the Jew with a swift blow that split his helmet, neck protector, and head, landing in his rear teeth, and the Muslims entered the city. Muhammad conquered Kumas, the
Jewish
neighborhood of Abi Hukaik. Safia bint Huyay was brought to him, and another woman with her. Bilal led them past some of the Jews we had slain, including the woman's dead husband. When she saw them, the woman with Safia cried out, slapped her face, and poured dust on her head. When Allah's Prophet saw her, he said, 'Take this she-devil away from me.'"
Grieving for those who have been butchered as a result of Islam was beyond Muhammad's capability. This woman cried as she was dragged past the mutilated corpses of her family and friends. Yet the man who had led the terrorist raids so that he could steal their possessions called the victim a devil. I dare say that when you began this journey, you did not expect Islam to be this bad. This is a special kind of evil. Muhammad terrorized, plundered, and murdered while professing to be God's messenger. That, in my opinion, makes him the most wretched man who ever lived. Yes, I know that the Crusades and the Inquisition were brutal, and Protestantism was born out of lust for power, sex, and money. But it's not the same, not even remotely. The clerics and kings that conspired together to control their subjects hid the Bible and perverted its message. They were misguided hypocrites who used religion to satiate their own cravings. Muhammad, by contrast, claimed to speak for God. He didn't corrupt Islam, he made Islam, as perverted as the spirit that possessed him. Therefore, Muhammad's legacy haunts us today. It pains me beyond words to look into the eyes of a Muslim woman or a child trapped in Islam. There is almost no way to reach them. And if this tortures my soul, what must it do to our Creator? Islam, the curse of Muhammad, has damned over 2 billion men and women. It has left nothing but death and destruction, poverty and despair, persecution and indoctrination, terror and deceit in its wake. Muhammad was the prophet of doom. This beast of a man was now totally out of control, In both Tabati and Ishaq we find,
Muhammad commanded that Safiya should be kept behind him, and he threw his cloak over her. Thus the Muslims knew that he had chosen her for himself.
Moving on with the saga of the only religion to be born in a milieu of grotesque immorality, piracy, and terror, we are about to add torture to the list of Muhammad's hate crimes.
Tabari and Ishaq. Abi Hukayk,
Sufia's father,
held the treasure of the Nadir,
the second Jewish tribe Muhammad had exiled from Yathrib.
He was brought to Allah's messenger, and he questioned him, but Hukayk denied knowing where it was. So the prophet questioned other Jews. One said, I have seen Kinana,
Sufia's husband,
walk around a ruin. Muhammad had Kinana brought to him and said, Do you know that if we find it, I shall kill you? Yes, Kinana answered.
This was Muhammad's second assault on the Nadir. He had stolen their homes, their businesses, and their land the year after he besieged the Quanuka, a year before he slaughtered the Kareza. All the Nadir had left was what they had been able to carry on their backs. And remember, this accounting of events is from the Islamic Hadith. There is no other source of information from which a different impression may be drawn. Not a word concerning this man's life or deeds was chronicled within 250 years of his death apart from these books. Therefore, the Muhammad of Islam, the first Muslims, and the foundation of the religion are just as you are listening to them presented here. Alternate theories have nothing to stand on. With each act of violence, Islam's lone prophet became ever more gluttonous, more callous, heinous, and ultimately insane.
Tabari and Ishaq. The prophet commanded that the ruin should be dug up. Some treasure was extracted from it. Then Muhammad asked Kinana for the rest. He refused to surrender it. So Allah's messenger gave orders concerning him to Zabar, saying, Torture him until you root out and extract what he has. So Zubar kindled a fire on Kanana's chest, twirling it with his fire stick until Kinana was near death. Then the messenger gave him to Maslama, who beheaded him.
Torturing a man whose home and property he had stolen twice, and whose wife he was about to rape, demoted Muhammad from a bloodthirsty terrorist and pirate to a demonic sadist. Anyone who promotes Muhammad's verbal diarrhea is scripture. Muhammad's life is exemplary, or Muhammad's war manifesto as a peaceful religion is no better than the degenerate who began it all simply to satiate his own personal cravings. It is time we shed our ignorance and admit the truth about Islam. 63 years ago, Pearl Harbor was a wake-up call. America correctly identified the enemy and declared war on Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. Had the nation, in the aftermath of the September 11th bombings of New York and Washington, protected its citizens by declaring war on fundamental Islam for having perpetrated that attack, the world would have been safer today. By defending ourselves intelligently against those who attacked us, the legal context for rebuking the hateful and violent religiotech of Islam would have been established, as well as the ability to legally silence the deadly doctrine's most vocal advocates. Under those circumstances, anyone guilty of seducing lost souls, be it in the media, madras, or mosque, into the clutches of this religious dogma, could have been identified and punished. Ignoring Islam and going after Al-Qaeda is akin to targeting Hitler's SS instead of Nazism, or targeting the kamikazes instead of the belief system that turned them into suicidal killing machines. If we continue to fight the symptoms of this disease, like the fascist Ba'ath Party in Iraq and organizations like Al-Qaeda, the real villain, Islam, will manufacture more terrorists than the world can endure. And while I do not advocate murder, the most compassionate thing we could do is to silence, sideline, and defang Islamic clerics and warlords in the context of a justifiable defensive campaign to prevent them from sending thousands, if not millions, more to their doom.
Tabari and Ishaq. Allah's apostle besieged the final
Jewish
community of Kibar until they could hold out no longer. Finally, when they were certain that they would perish, they asked Muhammad to banish them and spare their lives, which he did. The Prophet took possession of all their property.
Before you look at this as an act of mercy, allowing the people to live that he had nearly starved to death, you should know that it was really economics. By getting the Jews to surrender, Muhammad claimed the entire spoil for himself.
Ishaq, when the people of Fadak heard what had happened, they sent word to the messenger asking him to banish them and spare their lives, saying they too would leave him their property. When the people of Kibar surrendered on these conditions, the survivors asked Muhammad to employ them on their farms for a half share of whatever they produced. They said, "We know more about farming,
seeing that you Muslims are terrorists and all."
So Muhammad made peace with them for a half share, provided that, "If we want to expel you, we may." He made a similar arrangement with the Fadak, so Kibar became the prey of the Muslim, while Fadak belonged exclusively to the Messenger of Allah, becoming his personal property, because the Muslims had not attacked its people with cavalry.
Prey is an apt description of what the Jews were to the first Muslims, and it was to be a never-ending assault.
Bukhari, Umar expelled all the Jews and Christians from Arabia. Allah's apostle, after conquering Kibar, thought of expelling Jews from the land, which, after he conquered it, belonged to Allah, Allah's apostle and the Muslims. But the Jews requested Allah's apostle to leave them there on the condition that they would do labor and get half the fruits the land would yield. Allah's apostle said, "We shall keep you on these terms as long as we wish." Thus they stayed until the time of Umar's caliphate, when he expelled them.
I realize that this is hard to believe. It's so inconsistent with our view of prophets and religions. Yet the bloodied and broken bodies of the Kibar Jews, like the Khareza before them, reveal what Islam does to men. Pure, fundamental, original, and uncorrupted Islam turned men into terrorists. They became as immoral as the beast who seduced them. As additional proof, I offer one of the most startling hadith in Islam.
Bukhari, the Prophet told an Ansar, "Choose one of your slave boys to serve me in my expedition to Kibar." So he chose me, even though I was just nearing puberty. I served Muhammad when he stopped to rest. I heard him saying repeatedly, "Allah, I seek refuge with you from distress and sorrow, from helplessness and laziness, from miserliness and cowardice, from being heavily in debt and from being overcome by men."
This is how Muhammad saw himself. It is what he had become. Muhammad was stressed, helpless, and lazy. He was a miser. Never having actually earned a dime in his life, Muhammad had no way to value capital or labor. He was always in debt, no matter how much he stole. The economic plight of the Islamic world is a direct result of Muhammad's unwillingness to engage in honest labor. It is why the Islamic nations remain the world's least productive. In fact, Muslims as a whole are destructive economically, stifling far more commerce than they inspire. And that's because their leader was a pirate. Islam was financed with stolen booty in the slave trade. As parasites, they survived by sucking every productive host within camel's ride dry. The Bedouins of Arabia were poor, and while the Jews were a tasty treat, Islam would soon sink its fangs into a more plentiful prey. Within a year, Muhammad would attack the Byzantines. Within three, his companions would subdue Arabia in the war of compulsion, taxing everyone. Within a decade, the first Muslims would conquer Yemen, Persia, Egypt, Syria, and Judea. Within a century, the sword of Islam would be wielded above the necks of millions, and it was all for money. They had plundered and raped, to be sure, but the principal tools were the zakat and jizya taxes, which they imposed on all people, rich and poor. But most of all, Muhammad was a coward, as are all Islamic imams today. They are ever ready to send others to their death, but never willing to fight themselves. They corrupt boys with promises of virginal rewards, while they remain in the comfort and safety of mosque and madrasa. Like most loud-mouthed bullies, Muhammad and those who followed him found pleasure in tormenting the defenseless. And with each passing day it became more evident that Muhammad had lost control of himself, and that he was overcome by men. The Medina Surahs have been fixated on attacking the deserters of Islam. Orders to submit and obey dominate his final revelations. As men sought freedom and peace, Muhammad reacted by becoming more dictatorial and warlike. As a result, Islamic nations are the least free places on earth. In the land of submission, there are no true democracies, no freedom of religion, of the press, of speech, or travel. 1 billion Muslims struggled to survive in countries brutalized by tyrants, and it's not hard to see why. The first Muslims emulated their warlord, becoming increasingly belligerent, callous, and brutal. So that leads us to a very unattractive place. As a direct result of Muhammad's personal failings, the Islamic world is devoid of everything civilized people hold dear. Muslims wallow in poverty. Life isn't worth living. They have no freedom of speech or religion. With the educational process focused on Quranic studies, Muslims are among the most poorly educated and most indoctrinated people on earth. Following the example of a perverted sexist, Muslim men abused women, and they are violent. 20% of the world's population is responsible for 90% of the planet's upheaval, terror, and war. If only 20% of Muslims are good ones, then that makes them 2,000% more violent than the rest of us. Frankly, I don't see any benefit to any of this. Islam is a liability the world could easily do without. In the prologue of Prophet of Doom, I shared a pair of quotes from Islamic scholars. This might be a good time to review them in the context of what we have just read. What may once have seemed extreme will now appear understated. Here is what Dr. D.S. Margoloth had to say. Quote, "The character attributed to Muhammad in the biography of Ibn Ishaq is exceedingly unfavorable. In order to gain his ends, Muhammad recoils from no expedient, and he approves of similar unscrupulousness on the part of his adherents when exercised in his interests. He organizes assassinations and wholesale massacres. His career as the tyrant of Medina is that of a robber chief whose political economy consists of securing and dividing plunder. He is himself an unbridled libertine, and he encourages the same passion in his followers. For whatever he does, he is prepared to plead the express authority of his deity. It is, however, impossible to find any Islamic religious doctrine which he is not prepared to abandon in order to secure a political end. At different points in his career, he abandons the unity of God and his claim to the title of prophet. This is a disagreeable picture for the founder of a religion, and it cannot be pleaded that it is a picture drawn by the enemy." End quote. Renan wrote, "Muslims were the first victims of Islam. Many times I have observed that fanaticism comes from a small number of dangerous men who maintain others in the practice of this religion by terror. To liberate the Muslim from his religion is the best service one can render him." Considering the nature of their prophet, it should be no surprise that the Islamic world is such a mess.
Bukhari, "When we reached Khaybar, Muhammad said that Allah had enabled him to conquer them. It was then that the beauty of Safiya was described to him. Her husband had been killed."
Actually brutalized.
"So Allah's apostle selected her for himself. He took her along with him until we reached a place called Sa'd, where her menzies were over, and he took her for his wife, consummating his marriage to her and forcing her to wear the veil." Bukhari, The Muslims said among themselves, "Will Safiya be one of the Prophet's wives, or just a lady captive and one of his possessions?"
Muhammad was guilty of every sex crime known to man. Pedophilia, incest, rape, polygamy, adultery, womanizing, fornication, sexism, and abetting prostitution. Worst of all, he rewarded his mercenaries by dividing captured young girls among them. It's little wonder his Quranic paradise was so perverted. The Sirah reports,
Ishaq, when the apostle married,
using a word designed to convey the nature of a moral and loving relationship, to this situation is repulsive.
Safiya, on his way out of town, she was beautified and combed, putting her in a fitting state for the messenger. The apostle passed the night with her in his tent. Abu Ayyub, girt with his sword, guarded the apostle, going round the tent until he saw him emerge in the morning. Abu said, "I was afraid for you with this woman, for you have killed her father, her husband, and her people."
Imagine for a moment being Safiya. You awaken one morning to find a gang of godless pirates prowling on the outskirts of your town. After rattling their sabers, you witness thousands of them performing a prostration prayer. You recognize them, for they are the same men who threw you out of your home in Yathrib. Their bone-chilling shouts of "Allahu Akbar" pierce your soul. Before you can run, the mercenaries swarm at you from every direction. They continue to howl as one thrusts a sword into your father's flesh. They torture your husband, building a fire on his chest, ultimately decapitating him. They murder your brothers. Then they shackle your cousins, hauling them away to become sex slaves. They ransack your home and strip the clothes off your family as they lay dying, all in a frenzied quest for booty. Hiding behind a door, you're terrified. Then it happens. One of the Muslims spots you. A crazed, demonic lust explodes on his face. He knocks you down, pressing his knee against your back while he ties your hands to your neck. You can hardly breathe. It's the worst moment of your life. The filthy, lice-ridden militant fondles you, dragging you past the bloodied bodies of your neighbors. You want to cry, to scream, but nothing comes out. Then you see Muhammad, the man you have grown to hate, the repulsive 60-year-old animal responsible for this horror. Yet he claims you as his prize, tossing his cloak over your head. His words, his very presence, make your skin crawl. But as his slave, you are helpless. He strips you of whatever little dignity you have left. Then he conquers your body just as he ravaged your people. Now consider the insanity of a man who claimed to be the messenger of God, raping a woman whose town he had terrorized, savaged and plundered, and then whose people he had enslaved. How could a man claim to be a prophet and yet be so demonic and sadistic he would force women to have sex with him, whose husband he had tortured and then beheaded, whose father he had assassinated, and whose cousins he had given in trade to one of his militants so that he might possess her? The problem with Muhammad isn't that he was the most vile man who ever lived. It's his legacy. He perpetrated these heinous crimes while claiming to be the best example, to be the ideal role model, an apostle speaking on behalf of God. This demented criminal established a new religion that has damned the souls of over 2 billion people. He inspired terrorism, and his legacy has led the world to the brink of global war. I do not know if any part of the following is accurate. However, if there is an element of truth, it is too little, too late. Every Jewish settlement within Muhammad's reach had been terrorized and plundered by him.
Bukhari, when Kabar was conquered, a sheep containing poison was given as a present to Allah's apostle. Tabari and Ishaq, when the messenger rested from his labor,
which says that terrorism and piracy were Muhammad's chosen occupations.
Zainab, the wife of Salam, served him a roast sheep. She had asked what part Muhammad liked best and was told that it was the shoulder and foreleg. So she loaded it with poison, also poisoning the rest. Then she placed it before him. He took a foreleg and chewed it, but he did not swallow. With him was Bishr, who, like the prophet, took some, but he swallowed it. The prophet spat out the lamb, saying, "This bone informs me that it has been poisoned."
Talking bones and a gluttonous man spitting out his favorite celebratory meal are a little far-fetched, but there is a reason for including the story. The cook was a Jew. This tale was concocted to infer that Kabar deserved to be sacked. No one had bothered to provide any justification for the initial raid.
Muhammad summoned the woman, and she confessed. He asked, "What led you to do this?"
This goon claimed that he was a prophet, and yet he couldn't figure this out. Good grief. It's like Hitler asking a Polish Jew why she wanted him dead.
She said, "You know full well what you have done to my people."
It was as if Muhammad was surprised when folks were upset with his terrorist tactics. Caught up in his make-believe world, he had lost all sense of reality.
Tabari and Ishaq. The messenger, during the illness from which he died, said to Bishr's mother, "At this very moment I feel my aorta being severed because of the food I ate with your son at Kabar."
Sure, that makes perfect sense. The poison he had spit out years before was killing him now.
The Muslims believed that in addition to the honor of prophethood, the messenger died a martyr.
Well, at least we know the reason for this sorry tale. Muslims who don't die martyrs have no chance of paradise. The cowardly terrorist needed to miscast his personal history to die a worthy death.
Tabari, Ishaq, and Bukhari. Having finished with Kabar, the apostle went to Wadi Qura and besieged its people for a while. Then we headed back to Medina, halting at Qura toward sunset. With Muhammad was a slave lad of his, whom Rifa'ah had given him. Suddenly, as we were setting down in the saddle of the prophet, a stray arrow came down and hit the slave boy, killing him. We congratulated him, saying, "May he enjoy paradise." But Allah's apostle said, "Certainly not. The sheet of cloth on his back is now being burnt on him in the hell fire. He pilfered it from the booty of the Muslims following the Kabar raid before it was duly distributed."
You apparently aren't allowed to steal anything that's already been stolen. And there's a significant conflict between Muhammad's personal example and the rallying cry of the Nation of Islam as they lure African Americans into their ranks. Muhammad not only enslaved people and built Islam on money earned selling people into bondage, he himself owned slaves. Boys were personal servants, and girls were for personal services. A poem recited on this day proclaims,
"Ishaq. Kabar was stormed by the apostle's squadron, fully armed, powerful, and strong. It brought certain humiliation with Muslim men in its midst. We attacked, and they met their doom. Muhammad conquered the Jews in fighting that day as they opened their eyes to our dust."
It's hardly sermon material. But sadly, imams have been preaching the following message for far too long.
Ishaq. Masood was one of those who found martyrdom at Kabar. Muhammad said, "He has with him now his two dark-eyed virgins. When a martyr is slain, his two virgins pet him, wiping the dust from his face. They say, 'May Allah throw dust on the face of the man who did this to you and slay him who slew you.'"
It's the antithesis of Christ, "Love your enemies." But that's really all Islam is. It's the antithesis of Judeo-Christianity. In the next installment of Islamic scripture, a Muslim deceives the Quraysh to collect his belongings. What's interesting is that Muhammad had given him permission to lie and to disavow Islam for money.
Ishaq. Hajjaj said to the apostle, "I have money scattered among the Meccan merchants, so give me permission to go and get it." Having got Muhammad's permission, he said, "I must tell lies." The apostle said, "Tell them."
Muhammad didn't heed Yahweh's commandment not to bear false witness. This prophet spit on the Ten Commandments. As a result, the Islamic world cannot build a productive economy or develop a stable democracy. The currency for both is trust. The spirit of deceit still haunts Muslims. The division of the
spoils of Kabar
was so important to the formation of Islam that both Ishaq and Tabari dedicate entire sections to it. One line in particular reveals Muhammad's motivation for attacking these Jews.
Tabari: Kabar was divided among the people who had been at Hudaybiyah.
Each time Muhammad's mercenaries got down on him, he plundered Jews. This was no exception. The prophet redeemed himself for having been disgraced at Hudaybiyah. He quieted his critics by sharing the booty from an easy kill.
Ishaq: Kabar was apportioned among the men of Hudaybiyah without regard to whether they were present at Kabar or not. The spoil was divided into 1,800 shares.
This Ishaq hadith reveals where the booty went.
When the spoil of Kabar was apportioned, the settlements of Shak and Natah were given to the Muslims, while Katiba was divided into 5 sections. Allah's fifth,
which Muhammad was the custodian,
the prophet's fifth, the share to the kindred,
Muhammad's kin,
maintenance of the prophet's wives,
now there's an honest report,
and payment to the men who acted as intermediaries in the peace negotiation with Fadak,
which enabled the prophet to confiscate the entire spoil. Instead of a religious awakening, it was a repulsive accounting.
Ishaq: Then the apostle distributed the booty between his relatives, his wives, and to other men and women. He gave his daughter Fatima 200 shares, Ali 100, Usama 250, Aisha 200, Bakr 100, Akil bin Abu Talib 140. In the name of Allah, Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, this is a memorandum of what Muhammad the Apostle of Allah gave his wives from the dates and wheat of Kabar, 180 loads.
The hadith lists additional special favors and bequeaths, but I'll spare you the gory details. The first Islamic historian said,
Tabari: The prophet conquered Kabar by force after fighting. Kabar was something that Allah gave as booty to his messenger. He took one-fifth of it and divided the remainder among the Muslims. The inhabitants who surrendered did so on condition that they should be expelled. Tabari: After the messenger had finished with the Kabar Jews, Allah cast terror into the hearts of the Jews in Fadak when they received news of what Allah had brought upon Kabar. Then they sent to Muhammad to make peace with him for half a share of Fadak's produce. Fadak became the exclusive property of Allah's messenger.
Peace, Islamic style, means surrender, and surrender means giving Muhammad everything. Continuing to impugn Islam's claim of tolerance, the Islamic scriptures reveal,
Tabari: The messenger said during his final illness, two religions cannot coexist in the Arabian Peninsula. Umar investigated the matter, then sent to the Jews, saying, Allah has given permission for you to be expelled, for I have received word that the prophet said that two religions cannot coexist in Arabia. Ishaq: We cannot accept the oaths of the Jews. Their infidelity is so great they swear falsely.
Bukhari also chronicled the dispensation of stolen property. Here is a sampling.
While we were besieging Kabar, a person threw a leather container containing some fat, and I ran to take it. Suddenly I looked behind, and behold, the prophet was there. So I felt shy to take it then. Bukhari: On the day of Kabar, Allah's apostle divided the war booty with the ratio of 2 shares for the horses and 1 share for the foot soldier. Bukhari: When we conquered Kabar, we gained neither gold nor silver as booty, but we gained cows, camels, goods, and gardens. Abu Huraya came to the prophet and asked him for a share from the Kabar booty. O Allah's apostle, do not give it to him. He is a strange guinea pig from Kadum al-Dan. On that the prophet said, Oh, sit down, and he did not give him a share. Bukhari, when Kabar was conquered, we said, now we will eat our fill of dates.
There are many more, but you get the picture. Islam was a religion only in the sense that it became one man's license to steal from many. Swimming in the blood and plunder of Kabar didn't satisfy all the sharks. Muhammad's militants went off on another feeding frenzy.
Tabari, Allah's apostle sent Umar with 30 men against the rear of the Hawazin. They traveled by night and hid by day. However, word reached the Hawazin, and they fled. Tabari, according to Waqidi, a 30-man raiding party led by Bahir went to the Banu Mura. His companions were killed, and he was carried away wounded with the dead. They returned to Medina.
So?
The messenger sent Abdallah al-Kalbi to the land of the Mura. During the raid, Usama and one of the Ansar killed Mirdas. When they overcame him, Usama said, I testify that there is no god but Allah. But we killed him anyway. Tabari, the raiding party led by Ghalib went to Abd Thalaba. One of Muhammad's slaves said, Prophet, I know where the Abd can be taken by surprise. So Muhammad sent him with Ghalib and 130 men. They raided Abd and drove off camels and sheep, bringing them back to Medina.
So then?
Tabari, a raiding party led by Bahir went to Yuman. What prompted this raiding party was that Husalail had been the guide of Muhammad at Kabar, and he came before the Prophet. He claimed that the Ghatafan had been summoned to march against him. The Muslims went out and captured camels and sheep. A slave belonging to Uyayna met them, and they killed him. Then they encountered Uyayna's army, which retreated.
So Muhammad returned to Mecca.
Tabari and Ishaq. When the apostle returned from Kabar, he sent out raiding parties and expeditions before he made the Hajj. When the Meccans heard of it, they got out of the Muslims' way. Gathering at the door of the assembly house to look at them, they said, Muhammad and his companions are in poverty and misery.
The warlord made a beeline for Allah's house.
Ishaq, the prophet stroked and kissed the black stone. Then he went out trotting around the Kaaba, as did his companions. When the temple concealed Muhammad from the Meccans, and he had istalama, which means to embrace, stroke, and kiss the southern corner of the Kaaba, he walked to istalama, the black stone, a second time. Then he harwala, which means to trot or prance, swinging the shoulders side to side in a gloating manner. Similarly, for three circumambulations, he walked the remainder of them. The apostle only did this to show off in front of the Quraysh.
It was so pagan and so childish of him. Muhammad not only kissed, fondled, and trotted around a black stone wedged into the wall of a pagan rock shrine, replete with 360 other rock idols, he claimed that this exhibition was Islamic sunnah. As such, the practice became obligatory Islamic ritual, with the binding power of law.
Ishaq, when the Prophet made his farewell pilgrimage, he adhered to the practice, making it required sunnah to be carried out forever.
While Muhammad had not yet stolen their town, he had usurped their idol and their religion. A poem from that black day says,
Ishaq, get out of the way, you infidel unbelievers. Every good thing goes with his apostle. O Lord, I believe in his word. We will fight you about its interpretations as we have fought about its revelations with strokes that will remove heads from shoulders, and we will make enemies of friends.
The Meccans were being told to get out of Muhammad's way, and yet it was their town, their god, their shrine, and their religious scam. Muhammad's example, as communicated through the Hadith, is being called good. That means terrorist raids, piracy, the slave trade, torture, assassinations, mass murder, deception, bribery, and rape are all good things in Islam. The line, I believe in his word, can only be interpreted two ways, and both are bad. Either the Quran was comprised of Muhammad's words, as his isn't capitalized and follows a reference to the apostle, or these hadith are being acknowledged as scripture, words in which to believe. The means Muslims said they would use to win the debate over Muhammad's interpretation of Qusay's scam and his claim to have received Allah's revelation would be swords, not words. The religion was too foolish, and the first Muslims were too ruthless to impose their doctrine any other way. Islam, properly deployed, severs heads and turns friends into enemies.
Tabari. According to Waqidi, Muhammad carried arms, helmets, and spears. He led 100 horses, appointing Bahir to be in charge of the weapons and Maslama to be in charge of the horses. When the Quraysh received word of this, it frightened them. The Prophet said, "Young or old, I have never been known but for keeping a promise. I do not want to bring in weapons against you, but the weapons will be close to me."
So, which story is true? This hadith says Muhammad never went back on a promise. But the Quran says in Surah 9:3,
"And an announcement from Allah and His Messenger to the people of the day of the great pilgrimage is that Allah and His Messenger dissolve treaty obligations with the pagans."
So who was lying, the Prophet or his God? Or were they both lying because they were one and the same? I have saved the third installment of Mein Kampf for after the Khabar raid, because with it, Muhammad became Hitler's equal. He had now murdered and enslaved the majority of Arabian Jews, just as Hitler had murdered and enslaved the preponderance of European Jews. Following a peace treaty, Muhammad used negotiation and his war machine to turn Fadak and Khabar into his own personal fiefdoms. In like fashion, Hitler parlayed the Munich Treaty with Neville Chamberlain into the acquisition of Czechoslovakia and then to the rout of Poland. But Muhammad and Hitler had more in common than just a demonstrated hatred for Jews and the willingness to use deceit and unprovoked violence. They were among a handful of men who founded their own religions. Hinduism didn't have a founder, and Buddha conceived a more enlightened way of life. Men turned it into a religion. Abraham didn't have a religion, and Moses simply documented the covenant between Yahweh and the Jewish people. As you know, the word religion doesn't even appear in the Hebrew Scriptures. Yeshua, the founder of Christianity, was anti-religious, saving his most heated words for the clerics of his day. So that leaves the Prophet and the Führer. They established religions to serve their personal agendas. Their scriptures were little more than reflections of their own flawed characters. Prophet of Doom is dedicated to exposing Islam, yet peering into Hitler's mind by examining Mein Kampf enables us to understand Muhammad and Islam in ways that would otherwise not be possible. While their motives and characters were identical, Hitler had a vastly superior intellect and was a far better writer than were either Muhammad or his god Allah. He was also more direct and honest, bearing his soul and scheme for all to see. Further, we know the consequence of ignoring Mein Kampf, and thus by implication, the consequence of ignoring Islam. By equating the Pelagius doctrines, it is my hope that the world will not suffer similarly. Diving back into where we left off, we discover that the Führer and the Prophet were equally fixated on money, on other people's money. They condemned financial transactions involving the Jews. In Mein Kampf, on page 426, we read, "The Jew considers all money transactions as his own privilege, which is why he exploits ruthlessly. Manipulating money has become his monopoly, especially his usurious rates of interest. It's a sign of open hatred, of his blood-sucking tyranny, a scourge of God." Allah agrees.
Quran 4, verse 160. "For the iniquity of the Jews we made unlawful for them certain things, in that they hindered many from Allah's way. They took usury, though they were forbidden, and they devoured men's wealth on false pretenses."
Insecure men like Muhammad and Hitler crave praise as much as they do sex, power, and money. They attack anyone they perceive as successful, bringing them down to their level, as they are inwardly threatened by them. The Jews were productive and thus had money. Empowered, these dictators simply took it from them, justifying their attacks by calling the Jews evil. Yet the Führer and the Prophet were possessed by the same demonic spirit, a spirit that needed to silence the voice of Yahweh's chosen people. Our first book, In the Company of Good and Evil, was a treatise on insecurity. It demonstrated, in a corporate setting, what this cancer does to men, organizations, and even nations, and why insecure people are the devil's easiest prey. Muhammad's nature, his character, motives, deeds, and scripture can best be understood when we see how the abuse he suffered as a child caused his emotional vacuum. For ultimately, the reason Hitler's and Muhammad's lives and mantras were so similar is that they both suffered from the same affliction. Insecurity causes men to say paranoid things like, Mein Kampf 427, no persecution can deter Jews from exploiting mankind. Even if you expel a Jew, he comes back again after a short time. So to prevent the Jew from this, one must take the soil out of his usurer's hand, making it illegal for him to own it. And if that doesn't suffice, you can always march them into the marketplace of Medina and cut off their heads, or march them into concentration camp and shower them with cyanide. The only human, and I use that term loosely, that rivaled Hitler in the theft of Jewish land, property, and lives was his mentor, Muhammad. Insecure men are particularly adept at stealing what belongs to others, and they must always give their dastardly deeds a moral spin. Their victims are verbally and physically abused. Speaking of the Jews, the Führer stole a page from the Quran, Mein Kampf 428. They are God's chastisement. The Jews have only received a thousandth of the reward they deserve for the sins they have committed. They sold themselves to the devil and landed in his domain. They are monsters who torture the beloved people to the point of despair. The Jew will be punished by heaven.
Quran 59 verse 14. The Jews are devoid of sense. There is a grievous punishment awaiting them. Satan tells them not to believe, so they will end up in hell. Ishaq and Quran 296. We will not remove a Jew from the punishment. They know the shameful thing that awaits them. Quran 4:55. Sufficient for the Jew is the flaming fire.
The dark spirit of Islam reports.
In Quran 33:26, Allah made the Jews leave their homes by terrorizing them, so that you killed some and made many captive, and he made you inherit their lands, their homes, and their wealth. He gave you a country you had not traversed before.
Jews represented less than 1% of the population of Arabia and of Germany, yet both men were fixated on punishing them, robbing them, annihilating them. The odds against the most prominent men to have established religions, singling out one race for retribution, is astronomical. The odds that it would be the same race, a pacifist people without an army or country, are incalculable. There must have been a reason. Jews are distinguished from other races by only one thing, their covenant with Yahweh. It is the relationship that brought us the Bible and the Messiah. Therefore, if we are looking behind the anti-Semite veil to see who is lurking there, we must search for a spirit who has something to lose from mankind having access to the truth about God and to salvation. Satan is such a spirit. He could well be the inspiration for everything we have witnessed in Islam and in Nazism. Jews were silenced and their scriptures were repudiated. Christians were terrorized and rendered impotent. And both religiotechs deceived mankind, reshaping the definition of good and evil. In Mein Kampf on page 432 we read, Jews twist things to make it appear as if others had wronged them, not vice versa. those who are especially stupid believe them and grant them unwarranted sympathy.
Ishak, a notable Jew, spoke to the apostle, twisting his tongue. He attacked Islam and reviled it. So Allah sent down, "Allah knows best about your enemies." Some of the Jews change words from their contexts and say, "We hear and disobey," twisting their tongues and attacking the religion, so Allah cursed them.
The similarity between this next Hitlerism and Mohammed's terrorist campaign against the Jews is chilling. Mein Kampf 445. The Jewish allure is broken only by terror. The success of such activity is enormous.
Quran 59 verse 2. It was Allah who drove the
Jewish
people of the book from their homes and into exile. They refused to believe and imagined that their strongholds would protect them against Allah. But Allah came at them from where they did not suspect and filled their hearts with terror. Their homes were destroyed. So learn a lesson, O men who have eyes. This is my warning. They shall taste the torment of fire.
Hitler called them crematoriums. But since Jews were pacifists, they had to be demonized. In Mein Kampf 444 we read, "The Jew is not the one who is attacked, but the attacker. But he will not stand for an honest fight and must use lies and calumny. They become the personification of the devil, the symbol of all evil."
Ishak, the Jews are a nation of liars. The Jews are a treacherous, lying, and evil people. Quran 59:14. They will not fight against you, save in fortified townships or from behind walls. Their hostility and hatred amongst themselves is strong. You would think they were united, but in their hearts they are divided. That is because these
Jews
are a people devoid of sense.
In shrill voices, the anti-Semite duet bellowed. Mein Kampf 447. The Jews slyly dupe the stupid Goyim into creating a Palestinian state. But they have no intention of building a Jewish state so that they might inhabit it. They only want a refuge for convicted rascals, international cheating, and a high school for future rogues.
Ishak, do you love Jews and their religion, you liver-hearted ass, and not Muhammad? Their religion will never march with ours. Jews make false professions about Islam, so Allah sent down, "Satan wishes to lead them astray." Ishak, Allah increases their sickness. A tormented doom awaits the Jews. Allah said, "They are mischief makers. They are fools. The Jews deny truth and contradict what the apostle has brought. I will mock them and let them continue to wander blindly."
It's not a very pretty tune. While we're on the subject of calling Jews mischief makers, consider the Quran's last surah. The punishment for those who wage war against Allah and His Prophet, and who are mischief makers in the land, is to kill them, or crucify them, or have a hand on one side and a foot on the other cut off, or banish them from the land. Such is their disgrace in this world, and in the hereafter their doom shall be dreadful. In Nazism, like Islam, to be a pacifist was nearly as bad as being Jewish. Pacifists didn't kill enough people to satisfy the boss or his spirit. Mein Kampf 394. One would have to wage war in order to arrive at pacifism. The victory of the pacifistic idea requires the conquest of the world by Germans, making the German the master of the globe. Allah shouted,
in Quran 9:38, "Believers, what is the matter with you that when you are asked to go forth and fight in Allah's cause, you cling to the earth? Do you prefer the life of this world to the hereafter? Unless you go forth, he will inflict and punish you with a painful doom and put others in your place."
The next Mein Kampf passage begins where the Quran left off. Page 393. Man has never conquered nature, in any affair. At most, he tries to lift the flap of her enormous veil of eternal riddles and secrets. He cannot dominate nature in any way, but knowledge of the secrets of nature, always capitalized, by the way, will enable him to rise to the position of master over all living things. But apart from this knowledge, an idea cannot conquer. Allah roars.
In Quran 3, verse 175, it is only the devil who would make men fear his messengers and frighten you. Fear them not, fear me, if you are true believers, and let not those grieve you who fall into unbelief hastily. Surely they can do no harm to Allah. They cannot injure him.
If you want to conquer men and become their master, nothing beats using Satan's secrets to create a violent and carnal religion. Such was the lesson of both Nazism and Islam.
Bukhari, our Prophet, the Messenger of our Lord, ordered us to fight you until you worship Allah alone or pay us the jizya tribute tax in submission. Our Prophet has informed us that our Lord says, whoever amongst us is killed as a martyr shall go to paradise to lead such a luxurious life as he has never seen, and whoever survives shall become your master.
Once Hitler exposed the nature of his spirit, biblically grounded Christians immediately recognized that his God was Satan. German pastors wrote Hitler a letter. They said, when blood, race, creed, and nationality are raised to the rank of qualities that guarantee eternity, the Christian is bound by the first commandment to reject the assumption. And we must come to the same conclusion about Islam. For the Quran's dark spirit says that killing guarantees paradise. His creed calls for blood, race war, and the Islamic domination of the world. Turning the page, we discover that religions are established by evil men because they put such men in control. The individual loses his individuality, sacrificing choice at the altar of obedience. Mein Kampf 4:11. True idealism, in other words religion, is nothing but the subjecting of the individual's life and interests to that of the community. The ultimate will of nature, capitalized N, therefore representing deity, leads men to acknowledging the privilege of force and strength. Here, the instinct is to unconsciously obey. It was Muhammad's favorite word, too.
Quran 47, verse 21. Were they to obey, showing their obedience in modest speech after a matter has been determined for them, it would have been better.
There are a limited number of ways to control people. Authority can be earned. It can be militaristic, seductive, coercive, or religious. Behaving in the manner necessary to earn authority was well beyond men like Muhammad and Hitler. Militaristic authority was something they both craved. As such, regimen bans all choice. Orders must be obeyed by unthinking servants. Although both men ended up as dictatorial warlords, they couldn't start out that way. So they turned to seduction, the first tool of pirate and profiteer. Muhammad, for example, enticed the unsuspecting into his lair with promises of booty and babes. Once these men had seduced sufficient militants into their ranks, they used them to terrorize others into submission. Terror is the principal tool of coercive manipulators. But nothing beats religion. It provides an individual with ultimate authority, and it's the perfect platform for raping the world. In Mein Kampf, page 456, we read, for with all great reforms, the remarkable thing is that at first they have only a single individual champion. The goal lays dormant until one man stands up as the proclaimer and flag-bearer of an old longing, and he helps it to victory in the form of a new idea. So saith the Führer. And the reason is, Mein Kampf, page 460, we must produce that spirit which enables a people to bear arms. And that's because when it comes to wars, holy wars are the most vicious. Mein Kampf 467. The movement intends to nationalize the masses by a ruthless and fanatically one-sided orientation. Islam and Nazism concentrate power in the hands of an uncontested dictator. Mein Kampf 478. The movement represents the absolute authority of the leader. The leader bears the highest unrestricted authority. Only the hero is chosen for this. Islam agrees.
Ishak, we were steadfast trusting in him. We have a prophet by whom we will conquer all men. Bukhari, I heard Allah's apostle saying, He who obeys me obeys Allah, and he who disobeys me disobeys Allah. He who obeys the chief obeys me, and he who disobeys the chief disobeys me.
It's a simple yet sinister formula. Muhammad said in Al-Tabari,
Rejoice, Allah has promised us victory after tribulation. This increased the Muslims' faith and submission. When cities were conquered, Muslims used to say, Conquer for yourselves whatever seems good to you, because all treasures were given to Muhammad.
Next, Hitler explains why Muhammad focused on gratifying men's flesh and why he needed to attack Judeo-Christianity during the formation of Islam. Mein Kampf 468. He who would win the masses must know the key which opens the door to their hearts, that being sex, power, and money, and failing that, the promise of babes in paradise. Its name is not objectivity, which is weakness, but willpower and strength. One can only succeed in winning the souls of people if, in addition to fighting for one's own aims, one destroys at the same time the supporters of the contrary. In the ruthless attack upon an adversary, the people see proof of their own right. They want victory of the stronger and annihilation, our unconditional surrender of the weaker. Islam means unconditional surrender. It achieves victory by annihilating all who oppose it.
Quran 88, verse 1. Some, all disbelievers, Jews and Christians, will be humiliated and scorched. Quran 60, verse 5. We reject you. Hostility and hate have come between us forever, unless you believe in Allah only. Ishaq. The apostle said, Their religion will never march with ours. Quran 8, verse 39. So fight them until there are no more non-Muslims and all submit to the religion of Allah alone in the whole world.
Hitler was the prophet and messenger of Nazism, a religion he conceived to serve his interests. As you read these words, think of Muhammad. Mein Kampf 481. An ingenious idea originates in the brains of a man who feels himself called upon to transmit his knowledge to the rest of mankind. He now preaches his views, and gradually he gains a certain circle of followers. The direct and personal transmittal of the ideas of a man to the rest of the world is the most ideal thing for the new doctrine. The community grows, and the doctrine retains its uniformity when the authority of the spiritual founder is recognized. This mirrors Islam's beginnings. It is exactly what we have been reading. Hitler's quote regarding the importance of having a Qibla like the Kaaba is so similar to Islam, he actually refers to Mecca. Mein Kampf 481. The geopolitical importance of a center of a movement cannot be overrated. Only the presence of such a center and place, bathed in the magic of a Mecca, can give a movement a force rooted in inter-unity. This is why Muhammad changed his Qibla to Mecca in the second surah. For the Prophet and for the Führer, victory was achieved by violently forcing their religion on others. Mein Kampf 486. The greatness of a movement is exclusively guaranteed by the unrestricted development of its inner strength to achieve final victory over all competitors. The justification for fighting to achieve complete victory is caused by absolute intolerance.
Muslim, I have been commanded to fight against all people until they testify to the fact that there is no God but Allah, and believe in me that I am the messenger, and in all that I have brought. Quran 9, verse 123. Fight the unbelievers around you, and let them find harshness in you.
Not only were Islam and Nazism founded as religions, they were both fanatical, forcing themselves upon the world. Mein Kampf 486. The greatness of every powerful organization or idea is rooted in religious fanaticism, with which it intolerably enforces itself against everything else, fanatically convinced of its own right. Listen to that again. The greatness of every powerful organization or idea is rooted in the religious fanaticism with which it intolerably enforces itself against everything else, fanatically convinced of its own right. In his final surah, Allah was as intolerant and fanatical as words allow.
Quran 5, verse 33. The punishment for those who wage war against Allah and His Prophet and make mischief in the land is to murder them, crucify them, or cut off a hand and foot on opposite sides. Their doom is dreadful. They will not escape the fire, suffering constantly.
Allah's apostle focused on a few principles and repeated them. Hitler explains why he did this. Mein Kampf 506. I carried out the proclamation of propaganda ruthlessly. Good propaganda influences the masses. It concentrates on a few points, and it is continuously repetitious, self-assured, and confident. Mein Kampf 512. I took up the word and began to interpret the program for the first time. The hall was filled with a people united by a new conviction, a new faith, and a new will. Muhammad's laundry list of requirements was shorter than Hitler's. He required submission, obedience, fighting, and money. Sounding like a commentary on Islam, the manifesto of the 20th century's most notorious terrorist says, Mein Kampf 570, one needs the great magnetic attraction which the masses follow under the forceful impression of a convincing force and unconditional beliefs, coupled with fanatical fighting courage. As one side, armed with all the weapons, sets out to storm an existing order, it will only succeed if resistance is clad in the form of a new faith, and if it exchanges weak slogans and cowardly defense for the battle cry of a courageous and brutal attack.
Ishak, men, do you know what you are pledging yourselves to in swearing allegiance to this man? Yes, in swearing allegiance to him, we are pledging ourselves to wage war against all mankind.
This, my friends, is identical to the oath all SS men swore to one Adolf Hitler. And they did what they promised to do. Hitler confirms the importance of forming a people-oriented religion. Mein Kampf 573. The word Völkisch, from the German word Volk, meaning people, was conceived to allow the formation of a close fighting community. The conception of Völkisch can be defined as unlimited in its practical application, just as the word religious. It is a very nice and cheap way to describe man as fundamentally religious. Nazism, like Islam, was founded as a religion, for the purpose of controlling men, fleecing men, and motivating men to fight. Hitler recognized that religion was a tool he could use to achieve his agenda, and like Muhammad, he hammered his point home. Mein Kampf 574. A religious idea will free the individual of individual thinking and acting. Forming the new faith is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. It is an unavoidable necessity. Its purpose is not to just create an ideal, but to form an eminently practical expedient. Listen to that again. The purpose of religion is not to create an ideal, but to form an eminently practical expedient. It has always been that way. Religion is a tool, an expedient wielded ruthlessly above the masses. Religion isn't the opiate of the people. It is a lethal poison. Hitler explains why Mohammed created Islam and bribed his men to become militants. Mein Kampf, 575. For the materialization of the ideals of a new view of life and the postulates derived from them takes place through the pure feeling in the inner will of men. These ideas can be used to form military power, and the fighting organization can inspire people to a glorious realization. Every view of life or religion, though it may be right, will remain without importance for the practical working out in detail of a nation's life, unless its principles have become the banner of a fighting movement. The dogmas now form the new basic principles of the people's community. This was the very recipe for Islam. Form a religion to create a force of men, then use that force to force the religion upon men. For Muhammad, it was the amalgamation of his political sunnah with his religious Quran that enabled him to guide inadequate men to their doom. In Hitler's words, from Mein Kampf, 576, the correct spiritual conception from which the program maker has to preach must be accompanied by the practical knowledge of the politician. Thus, an idea, as the guiding star of mankind, must unfortunately resign itself into taking into consideration the weaknesses of mankind if it wants to avoid failing. Mein Kampf, 577. The transformation of an ideal view of life into a tightly organized political community of believers and fighters, uniform in spirit and willpower, is the most significant achievement. Muhammad's Ummah, or political community of unified fighters, was the model for Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Quran 33, verse 60. Truly, if the hypocrites stir up sedition, if the agitators in the city do not desist, we shall urge you to go against them and set you over them. Then they will not be able to stay as your neighbor for any length of time. They shall have a curse on them. Wherever they are found, they shall be seized and slain without mercy, a fierce slaughter, murdered, a horrible murdering.
Now for the clincher. The motivation for Nazism as well as for Islam. Mein Kampf, 577. Therefore, out of the host of millions of people, one man must step forward in order to form, with an apodectic force, out of the wavering world of imagination of the masses, granite principles, and to take up the fight for their soul correctness, until out of the waves of a free world, a brazen rock of uniform combination of form and will arises. After all, freedom is so untidy in the hands of others.
Ishak, O people, this is Allah's apostle among you. Allah has honored and exalted you by him. So help him and strengthen him. Listen to his commands and obey them. Tabari, the people assembled in Mecca to swear allegiance to the messenger in submission. He received from them an oath of allegiance to Muhammad to heed and obey.
Der Fuhrer, like Der Prophet before him, saw himself as the final apostle in the line of Jewish prophets. He saw his role as correcting the errors of the prior religion, taking it away from the originators and giving it to his people for the purpose of suppression, the total eradication of freedom. Listen to these haunting words. Mein Kampf, 579. The Jew, Karl Marx, was really the only one among millions who, in the swamp of a decomposing world, recognized, with the keen eye of the prophet, the most essential poison elements, took them out, in order to render them, like a magician of the black arts, into a concentrated solution for the quicker destruction of the independent existence of free nations of the earth. But this was all in the service of his race, the Jews. The Marxist doctrine is the brief spiritual extract of the view of life that is generally valid today, but it plans to transmit the world systematically into the hands of Jewry. Hitler, hating the Jews, devised a Marxist derivative so that he could kill them with their own medicine. This, in essence, was the purpose of Muhammad's early Medina surahs. The exactitude which Hitler followed Muhammad's program continues. Mein Kampf 580. The eternal will, both capitalized and thus divine, dominates this universe to produce the victory of the better and stronger, and to demand the submission, or Islam, of the worse and weaker. The program not only values men differently, but also values the differences between individual men. Out of the masses emerges the importance of the person. Muhammad viewed non-Muslims as unclean infidels who should be enslaved and then slain, as they were merely fodder for hell's fires. Compare Hitler's view, Mein Kampf 580. I believe in the necessity of idealizing mankind. In the nigrified world of opposing ideas, my new culture is bound up with the Aryan. One who dares lay a hand upon the highest image of the Lord sins against the benevolent Creator. When this religious view of life corresponds to the innermost will of nature, capitalized thus divine, nature restores the forces which bind and lead the best of mankind to acquire the earth's possession. For the conquest of the entire globe, only the highest race, the master nation, will be called upon. Compare this to Muhammad's.
Tabari, Arabs are the most noble people in lineage, the most important, and the best in deeds. We were the first to respond to the call of the Prophet. We are Allah's helpers and the viziers of his messenger. We fight people until they believe in Allah. He who believes in Allah and his messenger has protected his life and possessions from us. As for one who disbelieves, we will fight him forever in the cause of Allah. Killing him is a small matter to us.
The scholars who translated Mein Kampf said, in quotes, "This begs the question, why should the superiority of the Aryan race be so important?" Hitler gives the answer in this vitally significant passage. The race must be maintained in a position of superiority because it is the only foundation upon which superiority can be conceded to the leader and exemplar of that race. Men are divided into rulers and ruled for racial aggrandizement. Those to whom guardianship is entrusted cannot tolerate any other ethical idea. End quote. Unlike Muhammad, Hitler was an honest false prophet. He told us, "I'm doing this for me."
Quran 33, verse 36, "It is not for the true believer to order their affairs if Allah and his apostle decree otherwise."
Muhammad had to invent a persona for the imaginary spirit enshrined in the black stone. Allah served to justify Muhammad's superiority, his claim to power and money. While Allah never spoke, never so much as even rolled over, the Quran repeats the message.
Obey Allah and his apostle.
Hitler simply replaced Allah with Aryan. It became, obey the Aryans and their apostle. Muhammad was a bit sneakier.
Muslim, we pledged an oath to the messenger of Allah that we would listen to and obey his orders. Quran 33:57. Those who speak negatively of Allah and his apostle shall be cursed.
The prophet of Nazism preached, Mein Kampf 583, "Therefore, I saw my own task as extracting a general view of life, or religion, and in modeling it into a dogmatic form. the clear demarcation of ideas suitable for bringing together those people who will pledge their allegiance to this, and through the organizational integration of humans to create the presumption for victory. The Quran shouts the same mantra.
Quran 33:22. The believers said, "This is what Allah and His Messenger promised us." It added to their faith, obedience, and submission. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with Allah and have gone out for jihad or holy fighting. Some have completed their vow to extreme and have been martyred, fighting and dying in His cause. And some are waiting, prepared for death in battle.
Muhammad used the words truly, verily, surely, and indeed to fallaciously imply that his muddled message was clear. So did Hitler, Mein Kampf, 592. Therefore, the first obligation of a new movement, which is based upon the foundation of a folkish view of life, is to see that the conception is clear. For if the leader lacks a specific spiritual force, he will fail to find the necessary weapons for his self-preservation. Surrounded by his weapons, Muhammad was also fixated on self-preservation when he said,
"In Ishaq, he will not allow me to perish."
Both religious doctrines were built upon the pagan practices of their ancestors. The Führer proclaimed, Mein Kampf, 594, "Therefore, it is an unbelievable offense to portray the Germans of the pre-Christian era as cultureless barbarians. This they never were." Hitler said this because he usurped the idolatrous rites, festivals, symbols, and deities of his pagan ancestors. It's reminiscent of Muhammad and Qusay. Hitler forewarned us that his methods, like Muhammad's, would be brutal and that the ends would justify the means. Mein Kampf, 596. Our determination must not be based upon the reaction or applause of our time, but on the binding obligation to a truth which we have realized, ennobling our methods today. Hitler's torch burned brighter, but not as long as Muhammad's. Yet the tyrants' lives were similar. Both came to see themselves as prophets when they were 40, having failed at other activities. They stumbled in their early years, recruiting an unimpressive number of adherents. Each composed scripture and recited racist drivel that most ignored. Only the dregs of society were enticed by their decadent promises. But in the last decade of each man's life, they had seduced enough like-minded men to become plundering pirates, sending armed marauders off to terrorize and conquer in their name. Modern technology enabled Hitler's goons to accomplish more faster. In 5 years, the Nazis savaged a landmass equal in size to 100 years of Islamic conquests. Hitler's definition of peace was identical to Muhammad's: surrender. Mein Kampf, 599. Our peace is not supported by the palm branches of a tearful pacifist or professional female mourner, but is founded by the victorious sword of a people of overlords which put the world into the service of a higher culture. I don't think Neville Chamberlain read these words before he put Czechoslovakia into the service of the Nazis. Similarly, George Bush failed to heed Allah's words when he endeavored to sell out Israel.
Quran 47:33. Believers, obey Allah and obey the Messenger. Do not falter, become faint-hearted or weak-kneed, crying for peace. Quran 9:3. Allah is not bound by any contract or treaty with disbelievers, nor is His apostle.
Muhammad viewed surrender, submission, obedience, the payment of taxes, and the forfeiture of property as peace.
Tabari, peace to whoever follows the right guidance.
Which is Islam, the Arabic word for surrender and submission.
To proceed, submit yourself, and you shall be safe. to body. The messenger of Allah besieged the Nadir Jews for 15 days. In the end, they made peace with him, on the condition that the Prophet would not shed their blood, and that their property and possessions would be his.
Replace the Third Reich with Islam, German with Arab, and this passage could have been Quranic. Mein Kampf, page 600. We have a solemn duty to act as God's viceroy on earth and to be his partner in the divine government of men. The Third Reich's energies are expanded on a noble endeavor, the aggrandizement of the chosen German race. Mein Kampf, 601. Our high mission is the benevolence of the Almighty. The German Reich must lead to a dominating position. If you were to distill the Medina Surahs and Sunnah down to a singular idea, this would be it. Who would have thought that we would find the central message of Islam summarized in Hitler's Mein Kampf?
Quran 8, verse 59. The infidel should not think that they can bypass Allah's law. Surely they cannot get away. Verse 88. Fight them until all opposition ends and all submit to Allah.
Mein Kampf 602. The fight must be carried out with unshakable persistence. We must be compelled to fight for the coming one, for the fighters' lives belong to the state. Since coming one was capitalized, Hitler was saying, I am the Messiah. You belong to me, and you must fight to make my dreams a reality. He was explaining Islam. Muhammad said it this way.
Quran 9, verse 111. Allah has purchased the believers, their lives and their goods. For them, in return, is the garden of paradise. If they fight in Allah's cause, they slay and are slain. They kill and are killed. Bukhari. Allah's apostle said, I have been ordered to fight with the people till they say, none has the right to be worshipped but Allah.
Clarifying the religion of submission, the Führer shared, Mein Kampf 602, authority is an end in itself, a powerful weapon in the service of the great struggle, a weapon to which everyone has to submit. Hitler, the 20th century's most evil criminal, told us that authority, Islam's submit and obey, was the purpose of his crusade. He told us that the religious doctrine of Mein Kampf was a weapon, and that the ultimate goal was Islam, submission. Because we did not listen then, the world was covered in blood. Mein Kampf 602. Therefore, in the fight for the new conception of a religious doctrine, which corresponds to the primal meaning of things, the pure religion of man, we will find fighting comrades. Mein Kampf 603. If an active force appears united towards one goal, this minority will rise to become the master of the world. World history is made by determined minorities. In the presumption of our victory, the best fighters will be found. This is among the most important passages in Mein Kampf. It explains what happened in Mecca, in Munich, and in Moscow, and what will happen in America. Religiously inspired, a minority will impose their religious doctrines on the majority. The presumption of victory justifies their ruthless tactics. Muslims represented less than 3% of the Meccan population during Muhammad's day, and yet they conquered the Quraysh, stealing their liberties. Only 3% of Germans were Nazis in the late 1920s when Hitler rose to power, yet they destroyed their nation and much of the world. Barely 3% of Russians were communists during Lenin's revolution, yet they managed to enslave and impoverish nearly a billion people for 80 years. 3% of Americans today call themselves Muslims. Speaking of Jewish children, the Führer plagiarizes Allah. Mein Kampf 606. In the Völkisch state, we will lift marriage out of race degradation in order to consecrate the image of the Lord and not the deformities of men who are half ape. Mein Kampf 640. It would be a criminal absurdity to train a half-ape to become a lawyer against the will of the eternal creator. The most talented beings denigrate in the proletarian swamp while the Negroes are trained for intellectual vocations.
Quran 2, verse 64. But you,
Jews,
went back on your word and were lost losers. So become apes, despised and hated. We made an example out of you.
Then, like Allah before him, Hitler attacked the church while he focused his doctrine on the flesh rather than the spirit. Mein Kampf 607. By endeavoring not to breed the best for posterity, churches sin against the image of the Lord. They speak to the spiritual and let the bearer, man, denigrate to depravity. The terrible ungodliness of the Christian faith in regard to the physically botched, miserable lot requires compensation. According to the author of Mein Kampf, the Nazis were justified when they imprisoned pastors and stole their churches because these pastors were focused on the spirit, not the flesh. Ever the bigot, Hitler combined his disgust for blacks with his disdain for Christianity. He said, "European peoples fall into a state of physical and moral leprosy as the missionary wanders off to Africa and establishes Negro missions, while our higher culture turns primitive and inferior human children into a foul breed of bastards." As we discovered in the anti-Semite chapter of Prophet of Doom, Muhammad was also a racist.
Ishak, I heard the apostle say, "Whoever wants to see Satan should look at Nabtal." He was a black man with long flowing hair, inflamed eyes, and dark ruddy cheeks. Allah sent down concerning him, "To those who annoy the prophet there is a painful punishment."
This became Surah 961.
Gabriel came to Muhammad and said, "If a black man comes to you, his heart is more gross than a donkey's."
While there is no evidence that Hitler slaughtered and enslaved blacks like his mentor Muhammad, it's obvious he didn't like them very much. Mein Kampf 608. Christian churches, instead of annoying the Negroes with missions which they neither wish nor understand, should teach Europeans to take pity on the poor little orphan in order to give him a father, rather than putting a sick child into the world which will bring itself and the rest of the world only misfortune and suffering. Reading these words is like having a conversation with Muhammad. Hitler is miffed at the church for abandoning him in his time of need, when he was a poor orphan boy. For allowing him to suffer, he will take his revenge. The religious establishment in Mecca was Qusay's Kaaba Inc. When its clerics failed to comfort the now famous orphan, there was hell to pay. Both men dedicated their lives to seeking revenge. And for insecure souls, vengeance is defined as forcing all foes to submit in abject humility. Such men feel lifted up when others are torn down. With this line, the pure defined Islam. Mein Kampf 608. The individual is nothing, and he has to submit.
Quran 4:65. They can have no real faith until they make you, Muhammad, judge in all disputes, and find in their souls no resistance against your decisions, accepting them with complete submission.
In this pithy quote, Hitler renounces Christianity, while at the same time garnering a divine ordinance to wage genocide against the Jews. Mein Kampf 6:10. The renunciation of the church can help put an end to the original sin of race poisoning and give the Almighty Creator a being as He Himself created them. The spirit that possessed both of these men hated Jews.
Quran 2, verse 61. Humiliation and wretchedness were stamped upon the Jews, and they were visited with Allah's wrath.
Der Fuhrer dedicated 20 pages to the process he intended to deploy to manufacture the perfect terrorist. In Mein Kampf, page 608, we find, his entire education and development has to be directed at giving him the conviction of being absolutely superior to others. With his physical force and skill, he has to win the belief in the invincibility of his race. Confidence in the leader will lead the German army to victory. And while he tried, he was not as adroit in this endeavor as was his mentor. This next excerpt reads like a segue from the Sunnah. It is a declaration of war, Islam style. Mein Kampf, 618. He who believes in our work of educating our people for peace and order will receive the force to break free from our present doom, to throw the shackles of slavery into the faces of our enemies.
Quran 8, verse 58. If you apprehend treachery from a people with whom you have a treaty, retaliate by breaking off relations with them.
Throughout the Islamic world, everyone is schooled in the Quran and Sunnah. They are taught its message of hate and unrelenting jihad. The chief Nazi saw merit in the Muslim solution. Mein Kampf 620. Education prepares men for future service in the army. It has to turn young men into soldiers. Men must be trained to use arms. They must learn to obey. Mein Kampf 621. Seized by confidence in his own force, a commonly experienced esprit de corps gives the conviction of invincibility. Muhammad preached.
Quran 8:65. O Prophet, urge the faithful to fight. If there are 20 among you with determination, they will vanquish 200. If there are 100, they will slaughter 1,000 unbelievers, for they are a people devoid of understanding.
Islamic clerics continue to plague the world by indoctrinating Muslims with a false sense of invincibility. Neither Muhammad nor Hitler valued women for anything more than their bodies. Mein Kampf 621. The goal of female education is invariably to teach motherhood. Mein Kampf 669. The German girl is a subject of the state. In his farewell sermon, the Prophet equated women to cattle.
Tabari, Allah permits you to shut them in separate rooms and to beat them, but not severely. If they abstain, they have the right to food and clothing. Treat women well, for they are like domestic animals, and they possess nothing themselves. Allah has made the enjoyment of their bodies lawful in his Quran.
About 10% of America's population was enslaved when Abraham Lincoln became president, and yet he righteously committed the nation to a war that freed them. And what was Rhodesia and the Republic of South Africa? The percentages were different, but so were the conditions. A racial group had their rights infringed. The world protested so vehemently, apartheid was ended. Yet, for 14 centuries, a bloc of nations stretching from Western Africa across the Middle East and to the doorstep of Asia has treated women as if they were domesticated animals who possess nothing themselves. But rather than free them, we call the nations that hold them in bondage our allies. Rather than speak out against the doctrine that enslaves women, we parade their spokesmen on national television. So the question is, have we lost our mind, or only our character, or have we simply lost sight of our God? Throughout the Islamic world, cleric and king maintain control by feeding the masses a continual diet of poison. Hitler knew all about such things. Mein Kampf 623. Loyalty, willingness to sacrifice, and silence are the virtues which a great people urgently need, and their indoctrination by way of education is more important than the things now fulfilled in their curriculum. The people need less knowledge and more self-restraint. And that's because, Mein Kampf 634, the folkish state will have to fight for his existence with a fanatical national enthusiasm. Nazism had to manufacture martyrs to survive. The translators of Mein Kampf said, quote, "The leaders of the SS and Hitler Youth organizations have instituted ritualistic exercises derived from a composite Germanic religion. Pagan ceremonies in honor of birth, death, marriage, and other phenomena use Hitler's pictures on altars." Speaking of Cusay and the pagan religious scam Mohammed inherited, Tabati and Ishak both report,
"His authority among the Quraysh was like a religion which the people followed and which could not be infringed. They always acted in accordance with its laws. They regarded it as filled with good omens and recognized his superiority and nobility."
A new religion is easier to sell when it's based upon an old one. A footnote in Mein Kampf reads like the Quran, quote, "Religious instruction degenerated into the exposition of anti-Semitic racial doctrine and apotheosis of the Führer. History is taught in accordance with the spirit of Mein Kampf. German children now recite, 'About thee stand thy people, O my Führer, in kindness and in wrath thou speaketh. Thou art, by God's decree, the voice of the people. In thee do they form and believe. Thou art the law in them. In thee vast planning and pure dreams are made to come true." End quote. Bringing everything into focus, Hitler proclaimed on page 650 of Mein Kampf, "Our belief in bringing about a faultless era does not relieve us of the obligation of fighting." This is reminiscent of Mohammed's obligatory fighting to bring an end to the period of ignorance and usher in the Islamic era.
Quran 4, verse 77. "When the order for fighting is issued, a party of them feared men as they ought to have feared Allah. They say, 'Our Lord, why have you ordained fighting for us? And why have you made war compulsory?'"
Apart from place and time, Mohammed and Hitler, Islam and Nazism, my recital and my struggle are the same. These men created their religions for their own personal benefit. They corrupted everything, making good look bad and bad look good. They spewed hatred for their enemies, Jews and Christians. And they enticed men to fight for their cause to satiate their cravings. It's as simple and as frightening as that. The Mein Kampf translator said, quote, "Nazism is not an economic doctrine vis-a-vis communism, capitalism, or fascism, as is commonly thought. Back when the religion was conceived and its gospel, Mein Kampf, was written, Nazis were unfamiliar with fascism. It wasn't until Hermann Göring returned from exile in Italy that they became informed. Hitler refused to be tied to any program of economic or fiscal policy. He was simply fixated on change. It would be some time before the Reichswehr program would be manifest in the doctrines of state control over domestic and export markets, the regimentation of industry, of labor, and capital, its control over the money supply, and its increased government expenditures." End quote. In this regard, Nazism was identical to Islam. Founded as a religious tool to empower a single individual, it failed all others by failing to establish any non-parasitic industry. Economically, Nazi Germany was as bankrupt as the Nation of Islam. From this perspective, Muslims, like Nazis, lose in every way. Muslims lose their soul, as the message is demonic. They lose their freedom, as the religitech requires submission. Muslims live in poverty, since the only worthy endeavor is fighting, and too many forfeit their lives, dying as martyrs for a lost cause. There is no benefit, no reason, no justification to tolerate Islam. Hitler was as self-centered as was Mohammed. Mein Kampf, 661. "A view of life must reject democracy and instead give the world the best people, the superior man, who must be obeyed."
Quran 33:21. "You have indeed a noble paradigm in the apostle of Allah." Quran 33:36. No Muslim has any choice after Allah and His Apostle have decided a matter.
Picking up where Allah left off, Der Führer proclaimed, Mein Kampf, 665, the inspired leader whom nature, capital N, therefore God, has endowed with special gifts must be selected.
Quran 33:56. Allah and His angels shower blessings on the Prophet. So believers, send your blessings on him and salute him with all respect, a worthy salutation. Those who annoy Allah and His messenger and speak evil things of them, Allah has cursed them and prepared a humiliating torment.
There are two reasons that Muhammad and Hitler established militaristic states. Militants were better equipped to steal what the dictators coveted, and military authority is unquestioned and absolute. The translators of Mein Kampf said, quote, inside an army, soldiers do not ask questions, inquire about their rights, or insist upon privileges. They obey the leader, end quotes. Mein Kampf 793. Army service secures absolute power of command, compelling obedience. While goose-stepping to the same beat, Der Führer and Der Prophet sang the same tune. Mein Kampf 669. There must be no decisions by the majority. The Reich must be built upon the principle of personality, read dictatorship. One man decides. He has absolute authority.
Quran 4, verse 114. He who disobeys the apostle after guidance has been revealed will burn in hell.
Nothing says tyranny like Islam. At least Hitler was an honest psychopath. He told us that he had established the religion of Nazism to compel men to obliterate all other doctrines. Mein Kampf 674. The fighter for our new ideal is compelled into battle to fight to abolish existing doctrines. The view of life is intolerant. It cannot be content to share power. It demands dictatorial exclusivity. All must be completely readjusted according to its views. Therefore, exactly like a religion, it cannot tolerate the simultaneous existence of any prior doctrine. It must destroy all other altars. Muhammad said such things too, as did his God. Each of the following quotes is from the
Spoils of War,
Surah. It explains why Muslims are willing to kill to achieve their monopoly.
Quran 8, verse 1. They ask you about the benefits of capturing the spoils of war. Tell them, the benefits belong to Allah and His Messenger, so fulfill your duty to Allah and the Prophet. Verse 5. Your Lord sent you from your homes to fight for the true cause. Verse 7. Allah wished to confirm the truth by His words. Wipe the infidels out to the last. Verse 12. I shall terrorize the infidels, so wound their bodies and incapacitate them, because they oppose Allah and His Apostle. 15. Believers, when you meet the unbelievers in battle, do not turn your back on them, for any Muslim who retreats will bring the wrath of Allah on himself and will abide in hell. Verse 72. Those who accepted Islam and left their homes to fight in Allah's cause with their possessions and persons, and those who gave them shelter and aided them, are your allies. You are only called to protect Muslims who fight. Verse 73. The infidels aid one another. Unless you do the same, there will be anarchy in the land. Those who accepted Islam and left their homes to fight in Allah's cause are good Muslims. Verse 57. If you meet them in battle, inflict on them such a defeat as would be a lesson for those who come after them, that they may be warned. Verse 59. The infidels should not think that they can get away from us. Prepare against them whatever arms and weaponry you can muster so that you may terrorize them. They are your enemy and Allah's enemy. Verse 71. He will give you mastery over them. Verse 39. So fight them until all opposition ends and the only religion is Islam.
The Bible's tacit prediction that Islam will be responsible for the last world war appears probable in this context. But it's a shame that 1.5 billion people, a quarter of the Earth's population, will die because we were willing to tolerate something this fixated on violent world conquest. As a footnote to these verses calling all Muslims to global war, the Noble Quran explains what Tabati wrote in his first commentary on the Quran. In it, he presented Muhammad's worldview. The nation of Islam must be united in world war against all non-Islamic peoples. The infidel killing fields were called Dar al-Harb, the place of war. Muhammad envisioned Muslim militants rising up as a single nation under the rule of a dictatorial Führer.
The best interpretation of the verse, "Those who disbelieve are allies of one another, and if Muslims of the world collectively do not do so and become allies as one united block," is Muslims must do what Allah has ordered. We must unite as one nation to make Allah's religion of Islam victorious. For there will be great wars, many battles, and much killing. There will be robbing, great mischief, corruption, and oppression. So to achieve victory, Muslims must unite under one Muslim leader.
Called Gog in Ezekiel's prophecy.
Muhammad said, "If the Muslim world gives a pledge to two chiefs, the second one must be killed." So it is an obligation, as proved by the Quran and the Prophet's hadith, that there must be only one Muslim chief for the whole Muslim world, and that all Muslims must unify around him.
While the Bible indicates that this leader will come from Turkey, the Saudi ruling family's favorite imam, al-Barak, sounds like the perfect candidate. The esteemed Islamic cleric said,
"I am against America. She is the root of all evils and wickedness on earth. Muslims, don't take Jews and Christians as allies. Muslim brothers do not have any mercy or compassion on them. Their blood, their money, or their flesh. Their women are yours to take legitimately. Allah made them yours. Why don't you enslave their women? Why don't you wage jihad? Why don't you pillage them?"